Welcome to CompTIA's Shark Bites podcast with Alan Shark, Executive Director at the Public Technology Institute.
Hi there, this is Alan Shark, and welcome to another episode of Shark Bites by the Public Technology Institute, now part of CompTIA, where we explore technology at the local level, the state level, and once in a while in other places. We interview some really fascinating people, and today is absolutely no exception. Today, we're going to have a conversation with Dr. Jonathan Reichenthal, who is kind of an interesting, has a lot to say. We came to know each other a little bit more formally recently when State Tech Magazine recognized a group of people being the people most to watch in the year 2020. And so I started doing a little research and saw a lot of things that I thought would make this conversation interesting. For example, Jonathan was the CIO of Palo Alto in California. He's the founder and CEO of Human Future, a technology consulting and investment company. And he's recently found himself in the news with the publication of his new book, which I am fascinated with, Smart Cities for Dummies, and has been very active in social media on Twitter and LinkedIn on smart city topics, including the benefits of cloud services in city government and how to measure progress in implementing smart city plans. So it's more than just talk. So Jonathan, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Alan. It's great to be here. And I got to compliment you on your podcast name, Shark Bites. That might be the best one ever. So great stuff.
Thank you. Well, you know, to me, a last name is a terrible thing to waste. So there we are. But, you know, we normally begin by talking about how we got to where we are. Each one of us has a unique story. You know, I've kind of given a quick glimpse of kind of things that you've done and doing. But, you know, were you in high school or college and said, when I grow up, I want to be a CIO? Because I'd like to see how, what led you to become the CIO of Palo Alto, the city of? And then from there, I have a number of other questions and we'll get into smart cities and your book.
Sure. Yeah, thanks for that. Well, for sure, very few of us have a career that's a straight line. You know, I admire those kids who, you know, they want to be an airline pilot or a medical doctor or something, and they go for it and they become that and they spend a career that way. But so many of us don't. Some of us sort of move through life and we see things that are interesting and we kind of go after them. I mean, the thread for me really is technology. I fell in love with technology at a very early age. And part of that was because of my older brother. You know, when I was a kid, my older brother had a VIC-20 and then a Commodore 64. Nodding your head, I think you know both of them.
Well, and I had a K-Pro too.
Great. And so, you know, there I am as a little boy kind of standing behind my brother who's sitting at desk, you know, programming, and I got sucked into it and realized saw this world, this incredible world that opened up to me. And you could program and make things happen on the screen and build games and stuff. So I was hooked. And so my career has been pretty technology centric. So that's a consistent thing. But I moved, you know, from Ireland to the United States. I'm an immigrant, you know, now about 25 years. And here in the US, I work for a big consulting firm. And by the way, you know, if you work at the time, it was the big eight, became the big six, and now it's the big four. If you work for one of those firms, even till today, it's an amazing place to do an apprenticeship. You know, it's like you get exposed to big companies and big business problems really early in your career, and that can help you a lot. And I was very lucky. I spent 15 years there and had many roles, including being the innovation director for the firm. And, you know, that was the first time in my life that, you know, I was doing work that felt like a hobby. And so when I got paid, it was like, wow, I get paid for doing this. I think everybody should do their hobby and then they'll never work a day in their life, you know. I get this opportunity to come to California to work for Tim O'Reilly at O'Reilly Media as their CIO. And, you know, one thing that's clear is if you look at my career, I'm taking on increasing levels of responsibility. So, you know, I'm starting off as a kind of a help desk guy very early on. Then I'm a manager, then a director. And then finally, you know, I get the top IT role, the CIO role. And I'm there for a couple of years up in Northern California. And I get a phone call from a headhunter a headhunter calls me out of the blue, pretty much. I'm kind of walking from my desk to, you know, a colleague's office, and my phone, my BlackBerry rings, and I pick it up, and this headhunter who I knew, she said, "Jonathan, would you work for a government? Would you work for a city?" And the way I tell the story always is, it's the moment when I could have said no, thank you, and hung up, but I decided to say, "Tell me more. I'm intrigued."
Let me ask you a question. Till this point in your consulting, had you been dealing with the public sector as a customer, or would this be totally new?
This was going to be new. This was remarkable. I had very little understanding of how cities and government in general worked. And in fact, it was that which was very intriguing to me. It was really compelling. One of the things that I haven't done in my career is sort of kind of go the lazy route. I haven't just done things that are easy. I want to go into environments that are difficult and complex, and I can grow and I can help. And so I was intrigued to work for a city. Wow. I was like, how do the traffic signals work? You know, how does public safety function? You know, what's the underlying technology to enable, you know, libraries in the 21st century? I was just really curious about these things. And I got all that and more. You know, I definitely working in the heart of Silicon Valley in a local city, it exposed me to the complete universe of what government means. And I was hooked. I was addicted, you know?
So now you're the CIO. You're having an interesting challenge because you now realize the public sector operates quite differently. Mm-hmm. How long were you there? And then what led you to the next step in your career?
Yeah. So I'd already been over 20 years in my career before I took or was lucky enough to get the role as a CIO of Palo Alto. And I stayed there for 7 years. And you know, as a CIO, that's actually quite a long tenure, as you know.
Yes.
It's one of those things. I look at it this way: the first year, you don't get much done. You know, you're basically onboarding. The second year, you start to do a few things, and by the third year, you're actually delivering. You know, so anybody who leaves a role, particularly a leadership role, less than 3 years, they haven't quite made an impact yet. And, you know, as you get into the fourth year and the fifth year, then you're making a difference. Hopefully you're starting to build a little bit of a legacy, something that you're going to leave behind there. I got vested and I got interested in the much bigger picture, which is the future of cities in general. And due to the work we were doing as a team in Palo Alto, people noticed. And so I started getting calls from, you know, the government of Singapore and the ministries in France and all over the world saying, what are you doing? How are you doing this? And what's working, what's not working? And I was like, I'm happy, I'm an educator. I'm happy to share with you. And so that got more and more exciting and more interesting. And, you know, there's a point in anyone's career where you start to see sort of a turning point where, you know, I was loving delivering to the community of Palo Alto. But increasingly, I was also starting to grow into this greater sort of global role. And I had to make a choice at some point. I was like, you can't do both. I can't do, you know, this consulting on the side and be 100% or, you know, 150% invested in Palo Alto, which was the case for the time I was there. So I decided, you know, I need a date. I need to figure out what's next for me. And actually, I'd love to do the bigger role full time. So in December 2018, I left the city at the same time as the city manager at the time retired. So he'd been in public service 35 years, and it was a good time. I didn't necessarily want to have to learn to work for a new boss and all that. It was a perfect time. And so I looked at a few things, a few ways of sort of making a bigger impact, not just focused on one city, but multiple cities and hopefully in a global capacity. And I explored different things. And finally, I sort of said, you know, here I am in Silicon Valley. I'm you know, at the right age. I got a lot of energy and I can, you know, I'm ready for this. And let me do my own thing. You know, this is the land of startups. So I started my own little boutique firm in January of 2019. you know, as we enter 2020, I was a little concerned. You know, here we have a pandemic that hits, and I'm like, whoa, it's not a good time to have my own little company. But this year's been good. It's been really good. So I feel very, very privileged and lucky. And I've been doing this now for 2 years, you know, really focused on education, consulting, and helping some social impact businesses try to scale.
And the need has never been greater. In fact, I've written a number of things about what I call the great pivot, how we've had to move to a total mobile workforce in like a week. There's just incredible stories, and people are really taking innovation seriously once they understand what innovation really is. But somewhere along the line, you got your doctorate too. You just love a challenge. So, you know, what led to that? And now you teach, and you have teaching rights at a number of universities.
Yes, yes. Well, you know, one of the, look, a PhD, as you know well, having worked hard for your one, is not for everybody, right? And the statistics about a decade ago were something like 50% of people never complete theirs. So it has quite a high dropout rate or failure rate. So it's not for everyone. When I was working for PricewaterhouseCoopers, now known as PwC, one of the big four, back in the 2000s, early 2000s, one of the perks was they reimbursed you for your tuition, you know, up to a certain point. And to me, that was like, wow, I'm going to be paid to go to school. I'm going to do this. So I actually got a master's degree with PwC. And then when I was on a roll, I said, you know, what the heck? Let's go. Let's keep going. And so I did. And this was back in 2003. Took me 3 years to get to earn the PhD. Which is, by the way, short for your listeners. That's quite quick. But I spent every waking hour that I wasn't working on that. And there's three reasons. One is, you know, obviously time and place, and the firm was going to pay for it. So that was important. Number two is I just have a love for learning. I just love, you know, the way I say it is, I want to know how things work. I'm just everything. I want to know how the world works, and there's no better way to do that than to research deeply, which I did for 3 years. And then the third thing was kind of ambition, right? I thought, as far as I know, we get one shot at this life, and we got to be all in. So let me try to be as well equipped as I can for, you know, the workforce and the opportunities ahead. I knew also it would allow me to teach at a university level, which is a passion of mine. But I'll tell you this quick story. You know, some people think, hey, if I get a master's degree or a PhD, I won't have any problem getting a job. And they think of it in those terms. Well, when I was in the orientation for the PhD program, the dean came in and did his little spiel, and he said, you guys, congratulations for being here. You know, good luck for the next few years. You're doing an amazing thing. This is a wonderful investment you're making in yourselves. But he said, I want to tell you something. When you leave this program and you graduate, you're going to see that doors will open for you. You will get invitations. You will be asked questions. You will get into meetings that you probably couldn't get in before. He said, and you will sit down there, and everybody will be ready to hear what you have to say. And there'll be a question, and then you'll open your mouth, and then you're all alone. Because at that point, it doesn't matter if you have 3 or 4 PhDs and 50 years of education. You are on your own once you open your mouth. So it's how you apply it, you know. And so I've tried my best to use it in a way that I help others, and I can make a contribution.
You know, something you said, I'm just going to cast in a different light. Sure. You know, for those who, and I'm part of this too, who love to learn continuously forever, mm-hmm. they always say the best way to learn is to teach. Yeah. Because it keeps you on your toes. It makes you try to remain relevant and yes. keep up, especially in technology.
Yeah.
So let's now move to a new focus. You have a book on Smart Cities for Dummies. I think that's a great title because I think smart cities, like some other labels, is used to describe so many things, and we could have an academic debate. Is that really
right?
A smart city? And what about the poor counties and the townships? Aren't they smart? And of course, we know the answer is it's an all-encompassing kind of term. I even have a book that came out in 2012, Towards Smart Cities.
Oh.
And it was a collection of international chapters and works, and you can get it on Amazon. But it was more of a quest, and now it seems that some people are now certifying that. Where are we with smart cities? In other words, there are some elements. I've identified in my writings and research 9, but you know, quality of life, safety. I mean, do you have your own metrics? Because I noticed that you are very keen on not just declaring something, but having some way of measuring. And how do we get there? And is it something more than excellence? You know, you recall a long time ago, you know, there was the quest for excellence. And it was never that you got there. It was always the journey to get there that made all the difference.
Yeah.
So well, what's your take on getting to the smart city? Are we there?
No. Well, to the last point first, cities are never finished. You know, this is very important, right? So, you know, you can build a factory, you know, you can make a car, you can, you know, design clothes, you can do things that have a kind of end game. But cities are in a constant state of evolution, whether they're growing. And by the way, some cities are shrinking and many cities are just evolving. So there is no sort of destiny. You can't say we're going to finish our city in 5 years and we can then wash our hands and we're all happy. No, it doesn't work that way. You know, the quick answer to this important question is, in my view, we're at the beginning of this journey. We're at the beginning of the smart city movement. And that term isn't as important as what it represents. And I think that was in your question too. We're really talking about the future of communities, the future of cities, and what it means for better experiences and more sustainability. And these are really key things. Can more people prosper in their communities than they do today? And that includes things like, you know, being more inclusive, having more equality and equity, having access to the same opportunities. These are things that don't exist today in most societies in the world. And it's a very, in my view, a good goal that we continue to thrive to build better communities and more sustainable ones. Now, what makes in many ways the sort of smart city movement unique, you know, outside of other city movements like healthy cities and green cities and that type of thing, is a real deep focus on the use of technology, right? So I wouldn't be complete if I said it's just about, you know, moving forward with better quality services and a better quality of life. It's like how we enable that. And so for me, it's about, you know, are there new technologies and new ways that we can deliver city services that are game changing? Can we use data in a way that helps cities make better decisions, that helps community members understand their communities better, and maybe even find a way to be more engaged in how the city operates? You know, can we use things like can we continue to innovate around transportation so we're not sitting in cars, you know, back to back for a couple hours on our commute and spewing carbon into the atmosphere and creating a climate emergency? I mean, can we do that better? You know, can we ride more bicycles or deploy light rail? And so you have, and the incredible thing, and you know this so well, what really is exciting about cities is they're vast in terms of their domains, right?
And growing.
I mean, if you have an interest, cities are probably going to have that interest delivered to you, whether it's healthcare, education, buildings, energy, you know, digitalization, and public safety. You know, it's just a really broad, fascinating topic. And that's why I wanted to get it down on paper. I wanted to write a book on how to do this based on my experiences. We were just saying just before we started recording, you know, you write a book like this and it's almost immediately out of date to a certain degree. So I've written this book like for a point in time and it's still going to be relevant for a while, but there's things I'm going to have to put now into the next edition because we're seeing how the technology, like urban innovation, which is the tech of cities, is evolving very, very quickly. I think the most important thing, because this was in your question, about this movement is, two parts I want to answer quickly. One is, it's important that city leaders make the decision that they can deliver their cities differently. that we shouldn't be trying to solve, you know, 21st century problems with 20th century solutions. We got to have, you know, both be focused on the 21st century. And so I think there's a leadership component to this. There's a big decision to be made. And then, you know, in terms of metrics, which that was in your question, my view on this is absolutely you've got to have metrics. You've got to measure your progress and have KPIs. However, it's going to reflect your community. I'm not a big fan of like, here's a set of 10 metrics, you know, check each of these. If you meet them, then you're a smart city. Because what's important to Helsinki or Marrakesh in Morocco, where I spoke this morning, or Melbourne, Australia, might not be, you know, important to other cities. And so I think the metrics need to reflect the needs of each community.
So you use the word leadership, and I want to come back to that because there's so many technology solutions. And as a technologist, I think we both share that right. As a passion. We see technological applications that can make life better. I remember when I was teaching at Rutgers in Newark, you know, the CIO there, you know, suddenly turned to me and said, you know, I just realized that we haven't looked at the bus routes in any measurable way in the last 35 years. Yeah. And here we want people to take more public transportation. But my question is, how do we get to the administrative leadership capacity? Because I believe the technology, they're a set of tools. They're out there yep. and getting better every day, especially when you introduce AI. But we still have governments that operate in silos. Mm-hmm. We still have a 20th century mindset in how we govern. You know, you have the transportation director that has nothing to say with the health director. Right. Public safety is often their little thing. And how do you get these silos? Yeah. Someone called them silos of excellence to be a little bit more engaging with one another. I mean, that to me is one of the great challenges. Is that something that you have any remedies for?
Well, I'll say I agree with you in that all what we're seeing sort of in a characteristic of the fourth industrial revolution is that it's not just about tech. It's about so much more. It's, you know, we can do a lot, but we often have to ask ourselves, should we do it? And can we do it? You know, are some of the more important questions. It's no longer, you know, does the tech exist or can we, you know, can we create it? So this case that exists to in a growing manner in our urban environments, there is now a lot of different solutions for you know, everything from public safety to better transportation and more energy efficiency. But we don't always see government leaders step up. And part of the issue there is, as you point out so well, the design of government, the design of how it's done. One of the things I recognized very early in my public sector career, particularly in a city, was in the private sector, you know, you're kind of all on a mission in the same direction. You know, if you produce a product or a service for a private organization, you know, if the CEO says, you know, our goal is to win this marketplace by this date and capture this much market share, everyone's going after it. We're all on the same bus going after it. The public sector, and particularly cities, are like multiple businesses. It's like having, you know, depending on the size of the city, anywhere from 15 to 35 to 80 different types of businesses who have no alignment. I mean, and I'll give the two extremes just to make the point. Cities typically have a police chief, maybe if they, you know, if they have a police department, they have a police chief who runs public safety. And a lot of cities have libraries. So they have a librarian, they have a director of libraries. Now they both serve the community, but what motivates them and how they go about it are completely different. There's no relationship really, right? And so how do you get folks like that to align around something like collaboration or to use common tool sets? Really difficult because their incentives are completely different. And so I think deeply embedded in this is that challenge, is if we're going to make big changes, if our cities are going to deliver high quality services, there's got to be much more integration. You see that, for example, in the city of Dubai, which always, you know, you'll find Dubai, you know, if you ever see a list of the best run cities in the world and those that use the term smart cities, Dubai is going to be probably in the top five usually. Mm-hmm. And I personally have experience with it. I work with the teams over there and I see what they do, and they have a deep sense of collaboration. And it's definitely leadership driven, and of course encouraged and incentivized. And I think for that reason it works. Another example is the country of Estonia. Now the country, not a city, but it's a very small country. I think the population is 2.5 million people, but they seem to work really tightly together. The federal services in Estonia are delivered really well. Part of that is they had the opportunity a few decades ago when the Berlin Wall came down to start from scratch because they had nothing. That's part of it. They're also small. That's part of it. But they also have a mentality of collaboration, of integrating systems, that there should be, a single source of truth when it comes to certain data sets, that there's only one identity for a citizen when they log into the system. So they made these conscious choices. And so I think this is one of the greatest challenges ahead for us. As new leaders come into cities with a sort of an internet native mindset, this is what they got to start to push. They got to start to push for greater collaboration and integration between departments. Because in my view, and I think yours too, based on our experiences, that's where you start to see the greatest and the best results.
So just like we have certifications for CIOs and all the technical disciplines, of course, CompTIA is the champion of that.
Sure.
But on the other hand, there seems to be a gap in terms of the leadership part. And that's something that I have kind of championed. I think we need to have some kind of certification in leadership academies to get more people on board for this collaborative thinking, to cut across these lines of silos and to, get these common results. But I have to say, Estonia, I've worked with some of their technology people. They are the first nation to actually incorporate artificial intelligence in their traffic court system. So if you go to traffic court, you're having kind of a robotic experience based on, a database. You can always appeal to a human, but they're there. And there is a luxury being small and starting from scratch. So I get that. So well, your book, go ahead.
Well, I just wanted to quickly weigh in and kind of support your notion there of the education part. I like the idea of certification a lot, and it's helped me in my career and helped a lot of my staff. So I'm a big supporter. We need to have informed leaders, and a lot of what I do every day is has an educational component, even a podcast like this. If you don't have insider knowledge, you may have the desire, but you may not even know like what my options are and what the solutions are. So I can't think of an easier kind of path to getting better results than getting a better education, right? And if it means a consistent certification, like with project management or business analysis or whatever the case may be, in this case, a CIO role, I'm all in favor of that.
Good. So we're almost out of time here. So I wanted to ask you, when you wrote your book, who was your intended audience? Because when you read, all these wonderful titles that are out there about smart cities, my own book included, which is now quite dated, but for dummies. So who was your intent? I mean, that sends an interesting signal out there. I mean, it certainly grabs attention. But who are the people who would most benefit from reading your book?
I know. I have to say, I agree with you. I think it's one of the greatest titles for a book ever. Smart and dummies and dumb in the same name. That's pretty funny. I'll tell you a quick story. I'm quite active on Twitter, as you probably know. And I was reading some thread, some conversation between a few people, and somebody said, it was something to the effect of, but how are we ever going to learn how to create a smart city? And I wrote, read Smart Cities for Dummies. And time went by, and I happened to get on the call with one of the ladies that were part of the dialogue. And early on in the conversation, I said, I wrote the book Smart Cities for Dummies. And she laughed and she says, oh, I thought you were being insulting. She said, I thought you were saying, come on, dummy, read the book. When I was being practical, I was like, this is a book that'll tell you how to do it. It has its pros and cons, I suppose. When I was first approached by Wiley, the publisher, they really wanted to get more content and see a comprehensive book on smart cities. And so I was happy to say, yeah, let's do this. I'd love to do it. It was only later on that we decided to put it into the For Dummies brand, which, by the way, if you're listeners, it's surprising. It's the largest reference series in the world by a long shot. There are 250 million Dummies books And someone has estimated there's like one Dummies book in every shelf in every home in America. You know, that's how prolific it is. And it's well respected here. The Dummies title actually sometimes can not be well understood in some parts of Europe. But I think they're getting it. My target audience, when we were talking about how do we write this and who do we target, was a number of people. Number one, of course, city leaders. No question that if you're a mayor, city manager, city administrator, a CIO, CTO, a lot of the leadership in cities, this was going to be super focused for you. I also wanted to write it for vendors, people selling to cities, because so many vendors and particularly tech vendors mess that up. And I'm the first, because I was a buyer. Remember, I was a CIO for a city. I sat on the other side of the table and saw companies try to sell to me, and I saw how much they struggled, how much they didn't understand, you know, the dynamic of the public sector. So I wrote it for the vendor community too, which is sizable. Academia, believe it or not, use it. Not so much outside of the US, but here in the US, Dummies books are often used in certain contexts in academia, and I'm happy to hear that. Dummies books are very much, very frequently used and available in libraries around the world as of course, a reference book. And then you've got sort of everyone else, right? You've got families, you have business people. And one of the surprises to me, by the way, because people send me photographs of them with the book. It's kind of cool in front of, you know, city landmarks around the world. And one of the things that surprised me was how many children enjoy it. They really enjoy reading. I mean, cities are fascinating for kids, and they're amazed by things like self-driving cars and the role of blockchain and the role of artificial intelligence in cities, buildings and fire trucks and all those, you know, also all those types of things. So I have a nice youth audience as well for the book. But don't be thrown off by the title Dummies. This is a pretty sophisticated and thorough book for everybody. It really is a how-to. I mean, if you want to know how to deploy urban innovation or utilize data or, understand the dynamics of green buildings, you're gonna find it in the book.
So if you used any one of those descriptors you just mentioned, you would sold out. You know, I mean, what right. You have is like, wow, this is an approachable topic. This is an approachable thing. So you kind of bring them right in and saying, you know, this has to be so complicated. So very, very clever. Well, nice. We're going to leave it there. I think this may require us meeting again in about a year or less and pick up where we left off and see how things are progressing in the world of technology innovation and urban renewal and urban growth, because everyone's moving back to the cities. Although now with the pandemic, that may reverse a little bit, but they'll come back.
Yep.
So I want to thank you, Jonathan, for sharing some time with us today. For those of you joining us, it's Dr. Jonathan Reichenthal, who is an author, former CIO, business manager, leader, consultant, wears tons of hats, and an academic. So what a great conversation. We could have gone for another hour at least. So Jonathan, thank you for your time.
Thank you, Alan. I really enjoyed our time together. Great questions, a great topic, and thanks for doing this.
This has been a production of PTI, the Public Technology Institute. To learn more, visit pti.org.